In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear part two of the interview with Susan Conley, who has endured years of covert harassment, psychotronic attack, and organized stalking. Her home has been repeatedly broken into. Clothes, jewelry, food has been stolen. Her experiences match classic descriptions of organized stalking, as outlined by author Dr. John Hall in his book, A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. Why is this topic important to document? There are hundreds, probably thousands, of cases in which targeted individuals are quietly suffering. Some are isolated, written off by friends, family, medical personnel, law enforcement, and coworkers as unstable or mentally ill. It's not easy to conclusively connect the dots in many of these cases, but that's the point of covert harassment. We put more pieces together in this second interview, exploring the litany of strange experiences impacting the life of our guest, Susan Conley. She joins us to share more experiences regarding her case of organized stalking. Susan, welcome back to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff.
In our last interview, you described one of several times when you had woken up as if from a drugged state. In this next situation, you awakened propped up in your bed, pillows behind your back. Would you please tell listeners about this?
Yes, this was after I moved to Virginia, which was about 8 to 9 months ago. I had lived here maybe a month or so, and I recall waking up, you know, later in the morning, perhaps around 10 or 10:30, and I was propped up on about three pillows on my back, obviously facing the pillows. I remember looking around somewhat and feeling very groggy and disoriented. And then I also was became very conscious of my body position, which was sitting up almost, but laying on my back in a way. And I remember thinking that this is odd because I never sleep on my back. I've always slept on, you know, either my left side or my right side. I alternate during the night, actually never even my stomach. So waking up on my back, you know, sort of in a sitting up position struck me as very odd. And then as I became more conscious of my surroundings, I remember seeing three or four droplets of blood on one side on my sheets. On the other side, there was just a small pool of vomit. And it just struck me also as very frightening because I wasn't quite sure of what was going on. I didn't feel like I had, you know, your regular normal rested sleep. And I just laid there for a while and just kind of got my surroundings, my bearings and all that, and just, you know, slowly sat myself up. And I also remembered then, as I was sitting up, the blankets were, you know, halfway off the bed and the sheets were in disarray. And, you know, I'm not like a wild sleeper, so to speak. So that was a little strange as well. And as I was, you know, getting up, making the bed, you know, looking at all this, I noticed that the sheets were or had been torn in like, oh, multiple places, maybe 10 to 12 places. And as I looked closer, there were patches of fabric underneath the sheets. So they had been repaired in some way. It was just a frightening experience. And as I went through my day, I began to notice, you know, just this odd metallic taste of blood in my mouth. I just felt completely horrible. I also noticed at that time a small puncture wound in my knee. and a odd double bruise on the left side of my stomach. I had no idea where those type of injuries came from at all. And as I went into, you know, the next few days and routine and all that, I still was feeling pretty horrible and just sick in a way, but it didn't feel like a cold or a flu or any of the regular type illnesses. I just felt very drained and awful. And I don't know what prompted this, but with my tongue, I felt like a raised scar type incision on the inside of one cheek. And then I felt with the other side with my tongue, and there was that identical type mark or injury on the other side. And so I looked in the mirror, and from the back of my ears to the corner of my mouth, each side, there were identical incision type marks, I'll call them for lack of a better term, you know, from the base of my ear to the corner of my mouth. And that was the first time, you know, I had ever noticed those. And I'm only assuming those injuries or cuts were, I had gotten them during that night and when I had woken up that morning in sort of that stupor, propped up and everything.
Do you think the incisions were related to the coppery taste in your mouth?
I do, actually. I think the coppery taste was, you know, like a metallic, like, you know, maybe perhaps bleeding a little. If I think back to maybe, you know, some dental work or something like that, or maybe if you bite your tongue or lip, it's kind of that taste, that coppery, just slightly metal taste, which is blood. Yeah, I do.
I would imagine that you're wondering what happened during that night. Is there any way someone could have gotten into your bedroom, physically come into your bedroom that you know of?
I'm sure there is. When I first moved here, there was not an alarm system. Probably about 2 months after I was here, one was put in, and then this home was broken into at least twice. So I can only surmise that the alarm system was compromised. I don't know, and I'm just guessing, I don't know if the perpetrators obtain a copy of the software or something like that, or if they're just so highly skilled they can disable the alarm system or something like that. So, yeah, I think it's entirely probable that they did get in this house, either through just the regular front door or a window, something like that.
And Susan, you went to the doctor to have these incisions examined. Tell listeners about that.
I did. I subsequently went to the doctor, oh, probably about 4 to 6 weeks after I noticed them. And the doctor said that they looked like incision, like a laser type mark on each side. But this was not a surgeon. It was an ear, nose, and throat doctor. He didn't have any idea as to what they might be for or something like that. But he did confirm that those marks that he saw were not something that a layperson, such as even myself, could have possibly done. They were just too precise on either side, and especially from the back of the ear to the corner of the mouth. And I had a recent dental exam as well about 2 weeks ago, and that dentist had said that it's not something my, you know, teeth could have made, maybe like biting down during the night or something like that. So I do have independent, you know, confirmations that these marks or cuts are something outside of, you know, what I could have done or, you know, a simple layperson. They are definitely professional, so to speak.
This happened August 2018, and the scars are still in your mouth.
That is correct, yes.
What do you think happened that night?
I honestly don't know. I don't have a memory of, you know, anything at all. I'm sure I went to sleep as normal and just remember, you know, late that morning waking up with those very odd injuries in the bed in disarray, but I have no memory of anything that could have transpired that night.
This particular case is important, Susan, because of the past, what seemed like drugging episodes that you've experienced. It's not uncommon for people who have endured organized stalking to experience this. And we talked previously about this particular drug that is native to the country of Colombia in South America called the Devil's Breath, that stays in your system for 24 hours. Maybe you can tell listeners a little more about this particular drug.
From what I know about it, it's very, very deadly and dangerous, but it is used in multiple instances, perhaps a rape or sex trafficking, any other horrendous crime like that, merely because it does leave the system within 24 hours, and also no memories are formed. Short-term memory is not converted to long-term memory with this particular drug, is my understanding. It's just a very, very deadly plant and or drug that I've read about.
Yes, I watched a documentary on it, and they were saying that straight from the plant, it's a hallucinogenic, that I think you can eat the seeds and get high. But when it's mixed with other chemicals, it becomes a very deadly agent, basically erases your memory. But you're very complicit to do anything anyone suggests.
Yes, I've read of instances where, you know, say a person helps a thief steal their belongings, move them out, and in obviously much more horrendous cases, perhaps a rape victim would be very complicit in engaging in that activity, and that's just horrifying to think about.
So that's another case here that you've experienced where it seems like you've awakened from a drugged state and you've experienced a number of injuries and abuse.
Yes, absolutely.
To move on to another important event, in our last interview, you mentioned how you've had your cell phone stolen from your home and then it's been returned. You suspect it was cloned. I've not heard about the cloning of cell phones before. Would you give listeners a summary of this activity?
Yes, I've had my cell phone stolen three times. And in each instance, say, for example, the first instance, I went to sleep and I know it was in the bed with me or on the nightstand, and it was not there in the morning. A couple weeks later, it was returned. And what I've since found out is that, yes, cell phones can be cloned. The thief, perpetrator, must have, you know, your physical phone, and then they can have another phone that actually can duplicate your original phone. And, you know, they have to have some high-tech equipment like a scanner, and of course have to know your phone's identification number. But, you know, if they have your physical phone and then your phone's identification number, they can easily clone it. And basically that gives them, with this duplicated phone now, they can see all of your texts, your, you know, phone calls, your contact log, your emails, if you have an email account set up on there, any pictures you might have, you know, everything, basically everything you have on your phone, they can see on this duplicated phone. And, you know, that's pretty frightening. That's like, it's a complete invasion of privacy, yeah.
Right, it's very disturbing. So they can watch your every move and correspondence with anyone. A month after moving to your new home in Virginia, another strange situation occurred when you couldn't find your phone. A lot of things happened this day, including seeing flashes of light in your front yard. Please take listeners through that particular day, beginning with searching for your phone.
Yes, I recall it was later in an afternoon, and I could not find my cell phone. I probably wanted to make a call or something like that, but I couldn't find it. After searching my room, I decided to call my cell number from the landline here at the house. So I did that, and I heard my phone ringing. I found it actually under my bed in my bedroom, which I found to be odd because I'm pretty sure I didn't place it under my bed. But anyway, I did find it there. So, you know, found it, answered the call from the landline, hung up and all that. And a few minutes later, I heard my cell phone ring, the actual ringtone on my cell phone. I heard it ringing over and over. And, you know, I had my cell phone with me then. And I remember looking at my cell phone thinking, well, my cell phone itself is not ringing, yet I'm hearing the ringtone that I have set on my cell phone ringing throughout the upstairs of the house. So I decided to walk around and kind of try and trace where that ringtone was coming from. And I traced it to the kitchen area. And I actually made a few calls from the landline again to my cell number to see if I could hear like maybe a double ringtone or something like that. And, you know, my cell phone would ring, but then, yeah, kind of as an echo or something like that, I heard this other secondary ringtone, which obviously was still the same tone as my cell phone. So anyway, I just decided to trace that, and it just seemed like within the kitchen area, it was coming from almost like underneath the floor. And underneath that floor was, you know, like, or the basement area, kind of like outside where the basement starts, and there's also a deck. So I walked outside and, you know, still listening to this ringtone. And I traced the ringing coming from under the deck. There is this dirt area adjacent to the basement. And it just kept ringing and ringing and ringing, and it wasn't stopping. And I texted my roommate to actually come out and experience, you know, hear what I'm hearing. And she did, and we made a few test calls, and the ringing pretty much abruptly stopped. At the same time, we heard this conversation, you know, you couldn't hear the actual verbiage, but it was a conversation, you know, people talking back and forth, and it seemed to be coming from the neighbor's adjacent property. There's just one neighbor to the right of us. You know, as soon as we heard that, and I said, oh, well, now there's talking coming from the neighbor's property, but it was a phone conversation that appeared to be projecting from outside, not like in a house. But as soon as I said that, that stopped. And that was the extent of that afternoon or that experience.
You were unable to find where that phone was?
Do you mean the ringing that I heard over and over?
Right.
That's correct. Yeah, it was just the ringing. I could not find an actual phone, you know, another phone that was, you know, having that ringing occurring. It pretty much stopped almost as soon as, you know, we got out there after we started talking a little bit and then heard the neighbor's conversation and then as soon as then I pointed out the neighbor's, you know, conversation, that stopped as well. My friend had to get back to work. She works out of the home in here. So that was the extent of that experience, yes.
What would you conclude from something like this happening?
My conclusion would be the cell phone that I have now was in the process of perhaps being cloned. I mean, I'm just speculating at this time. Perhaps there was another phone that was being, you know, duplicated or something like that. Or I'm just speculating, maybe there was some type of equipment going in to monitor calls on maybe the landline and the cell number. I'm not really sure. I never actually did figure that out.
Very bizarre, Susan, nonetheless. So later that day?
So later that evening, around 7 or 8 p.m., I was letting my little dog out for the night. I'm just kind of standing around, watching him wander around. And I heard, it was to the left of me, just a few feet away, I kept hearing this recording over and over. It was, your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up and dial the number again. Over and over, you know, the standard recording you hear from a phone company, like if you misdial a number, it's, you know, maybe you just dialed six digits instead of seven or whatever. Just, your call cannot be completed as dialed. Please hang up and dial the number again. And I remember looking over to where I heard this recording being played over and over, thinking, what the heck? You know, this is something you hear if you're trying to make a call, it's just not going through or whatever. And I saw, and I was just staring in that direction where I was hearing this, and I saw maybe a flash or two of a real subtle light, or kind of like a reflection kind of thing. And I saw a face. It was a male face, but nothing else was really discernible, just shorter hair and maybe younger, but just a flash of a face, and then it was gone. It was just this kind of couple flashes of light, a glint of a reflection a little bit, like if in a mirror, and then this face, and it was gone. And that was that. I mean, I did not walk over and try and figure out what I saw or anything like that. I was actually a bit scared. I had my little dog out, so I just, you know, I brought him back inside, and then I decided to then walk back out just myself again, and I didn't hear the recording anymore. But then I started to hear odd sounds, as if I was in a jungle or something like that. And, you know, this is the southeast United States. There's no jungle here. I heard, like, odd, wild, like perhaps a parrot sound, you know. It just seemed like exotic bird sounds. You know, if you've ever been to a pet store and hear parrots or something like that. And I heard perhaps a monkey sound, perhaps a small roar of a lion, and it was very bizarre. And then sometimes I would hear, depending on where I was walking, because at this point I was walking around the sides of the house and the front, and depending on where I was walking, I would hear different sounds. For example, if I walked very close to the right side of the house, the closer to the wall I got, I would hear a fire engine, you know, sound, wailing, things like that. And of course, the fire engine sound, you would think, well, of course, that could be normal, right? There could be an emergency, yet the closer I walked to the house, the louder it would get. So to me, that was kind of a warning type sound. And you could tell these sounds weren't original or normal, so to speak. They sounded like they were coming from perhaps some kind of speakers or playback device. Sometimes I would hear a train. The further I would go away from the house, the less I could hear this train sound. If I would walk down the driveway, I would hear almost like this whirring sound, like a chainsaw, but it really wasn't a chainsaw. Once in a while, I would hear a dog barking or a cat meowing. And to me, these sounds were very tinny sounding almost. Like I said, as if they were coming from a speaker or something like that. So I never did, you know, see anything, see anybody, as much as I walked around the house and tried to investigate. And, you know, after a while, I just finally went into the house and pretty much gave up. But if you ask me how I knew these sounds weren't real, where, like, you know, jungle sounds and things like that, you could just tell. It seemed like some kind of a warning type system to whatever was going on around here.
Certainly an interesting day you had, Susan. Getting back to the flash of light and the glimpse of a man's face.
Yeah.
Can you tell listeners where you were standing in the yard, and then where in the yard, the front yard, did you see the flash of light and the glimpse of this face? Could you tell listeners how far away this might have been? Give us a little bit more detail on the environment.
I was in the front yard here, probably just a couple feet away from the actual, you know, house itself. When I heard the recording and saw the glimpse of light and everything, it was just to the right of me, probably just a few hundred feet. And it wasn't, I don't believe it, the recording that I heard the glimpse of face I saw was actually on this property. It seemed to be coming from right on the neighbor's property, which is, oh gosh, at a few hundred feet from where I was at, probably on their driveway. Just when I remember looking over, trying to pinpoint where this recording could possibly be coming from, when I saw the couple flashes of light, kind of like a reflection, and then the face, it appeared to be coming from the neighbor's driveway. Perhaps this person was standing on the neighbor's driveway, doing whatever they were doing. And there's like some privacy type landscape planted, pine trees, I believe, just like on the other side of these trees. This person, I'm going to say person because I saw a face, was standing on the driveway.
This sounds very much like somebody wearing invisibility suits and had a decloaking malfunction, or some type of malfunction, and you happen to see it. That's possible. I interviewed Richard Schauengert a while back, who had patented the invisibility suits back in the early 90s. And let's hear a clip from that interview to give listeners some context of what we're talking about. You were able to maybe get confirmation that the concept is doable, and it would have to be
right.
Refined, meaning smaller, maybe cells, maybe more flexible cells, and
right, exactly. And my associate, his name is Lev Berger, L-E-V, first name and last name B-E-R-G-E-R. He has a little company out there, and he gave me a lot of assistance, and then we went together to another conference back in Pennsylvania and made a presentation that was well received also. And it was basically an extension of the first presentation I made.
Were you able to create the prototype and bring it with you during a presentation?
No, we never got that far as building a prototype, because it was still conceptual, and it would all depend on the people who were interested in it and what they really wanted. If they wanted a suit, you know, we'd have to develop a suit. But we never got that far, and then some companies stepped in and started doing work. This one in San Diego, SCIC, I believe it is, and they actually had a contract with one of the major government agencies, and they did some work on it. And I had a meeting with one of the people, but it didn't go too far. They were kind of picking my brains, and I was trying to figure out what they were really doing, but they couldn't tell me because it was, you know, a contract of their own, some proprietary rights and so forth. But right now, I've been retired 4 years. I'm not really in the technology field anymore. So all of this is just from memory.
For listeners, SCIC is Science Applications International Corporation.
Right, I believe that's correct.
There are a network of specialized corporations like SCIC. There's American Technology Corporation. There's American Research Associates. And some of these corporations are developing directed energy weapons or anti-gravity devices.
Right.
Richard and Camellio, Robert Guffey's book, you mentioned that the U.S. military had used your invisibility technology that you patented. When did this happen, and how did you find out?
Well, I found out that through the questions they asked me, I could tell that they already knew quite a bit about it. They did reveal that they had gotten some information through a friend of mine, and so I figured that's pretty good information, and they knew basically what they were talking about. And some people were at the first presentation I made to the Air Force down in San Antonio, and then Lev Berger and I went to the one in Philadelphia, made a presentation. So there were a lot of people there that were interested in it. So I know that some of them were in the defense field and were definitely working on things of this sort. So I feel almost certain they took my ideas and used them. And it could have infringed on my patent, but I didn't have anything concrete to really prove that.
Were you upset about this?
Well, somewhat, yes. But the military can use any invention. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but they can use any invention by anybody when they're using it for a military purpose, and there's absolutely nothing the owner can do about it. That's the way it is. If it's used for defense purposes, there's nothing they can do about it.
How did you find out that this was the case, that they were using your technology?
Well, just from the questions and how they asked them, I could deduce that they were using the same concept.
I suspect those night vision goggles mentioned in Robert Guffey's book, Camellio, weren't merely devices allowing one to see at night. I was thinking maybe they were special optics allowing those who were wearing invisibility suits to make themselves visible to each other. What are your thoughts on that?
I thought about that, but personally, I don't believe they had that ability to... I think they merely had the ability to see someone who were wearing the goggles, that's all.
It makes you think about the question, how do the people wearing invisibility suits see each other and coordinate maybe something together?
That's a good question. They would have to know the details of the suit, how the suit is made, and how it objects, the background on it. And so they would have to be close associates in order to do this, but I'm assuming they could figure out a way to realize that objective.
One thing that was very interesting to me in Robert's book, when he was describing how the weight of the person wearing the suit would sometimes give away the presence of somebody in an invisibility suit.
You mean by showing some imprint of their footprint or something like that? Or
creaking on a wooden floor?
Yeah, right. Yeah, they would have to be very careful about any sounds they made, walking or imprints they made, because these could be seen by someone.
Okay, that was a short excerpt from an interview with Richard Schauengart, who was among the first to patent the invisibility suits back in the 90s. The Pentagon has since used his patent and developed this technology many, many years ago. So you can imagine where they're at with this technology now. One of the more sinister elements of organized stalking is the complicity of family and friends who have suddenly become experts on mental health and psychiatry. When you were renting an apartment in Arizona, you moved to a hotel for an extended stay. A lot happened during that time, and this is important to document. Could you tell listeners about this experience, Susan?
Yes. When I was living in my apartment before last, there was a particular time period, December before last, actually, that I was terrorized and traumatized quite a bit. I was so afraid to go to sleep at night, afraid to run any errands, just very fearful of what I might find when I got home, whether it be, you know, food stolen and perhaps sometimes returned, and I didn't know what condition it might be returned in, items stolen or items moved around, things like that. And I just couldn't deal with the terror anymore, so I decided to rent an extended stay hotel room for a while just to, at the very least, catch up on some sleep and just wanted to feel safe, at least for a temporary period, a small short of time period. So I remember moving a lot of my, you know, personal items there, things you can't be replaced, and, you know, moved my pets over there, and I was just trying to get situated and everything. And it was probably, it was the second night I was there, actually. It was Christmas Day night, as a matter of fact. I just remember feeling very disconcerted and kind of just very sleepy. And to be honest with you, I'm sure I slept that night, but I don't remember too much. I remember waking up probably real early in the morning, 6 or 7 a.m., and I smelled this strange smell and couldn't quite get my bearings or figure out what was going on. I was, you know, trying to get up and do some things. And I remember looking over at the stove and the overhead portion of it, and there was a strange noise, and was staring at it. And I would hear this strange noise and this, for lack of a better term, steam, perhaps some type of gas substance would come down from it in intermittent periods, maybe every couple of minutes. And the smell was just getting worse and worse. And I was, you know, very frightened. I remember opening the windows in that room and the actual door of the hotel room. It was an outside type hotel where, you know, the doors to each room open to the outside. There was no interior to it. And that seemed to help quite a bit with the smell and everything else. And I just remember thinking, you know, I have to get myself and my pets out of here. And, you know, I don't know what had happened during the night. Perhaps we had been gassed or poisoned, whatever, during the night. I was afraid for their safety as well as mine because, you know, it was, you know, a tiny hotel room. And based on all the events that had happened to me in the past, I think my concerns were very valid. I had never had anything like that happen before where I'd seen like this seemingly colorless but not odorless, you know, gas or steam coming out from the stove. It wasn't right. I remember calling, you know, the front desk of the hotel, and they didn't seem to comprehend what I was trying to say. I'm sure I was in a panic, and obviously my mental state had been altered in some way by whatever this substance was. I remember asking to talk to the hotel manager, and he refused to do anything. I actually called their corporate headquarters. They couldn't do anything. And I finally just remember thinking, well, I can't try to get help anymore. And, you know, based on my experience in the past with the police, calling them did no good either. And I figured, well, if I call them and I don't know what will happen to my pets then, or will they even believe me? What if something is blamed on me? You know, I just had called them 3 times in the past and they basically did nothing. So anyway, I decided to pack up my pets. I took them to the emergency vet and, you know, wanted to have them looked at before myself because I can take care of myself, or at least I think, and they can't. So anyway, while I was at the vet, I had called my sister to tell her what had happened, who then called my parents. The vet staff, they must have obviously thought something was wrong with me because I was telling them, I think I've been poisoned. I think my pets have been poisoned. Please help them, and then I have to go get help. Well, they actually called the police, and based on my parents' input, because my sister had contacted them, I was inevitably taken to a hospital for people who are perceived as perhaps having a mental event, something like that. So I was detained in a hospital against my will for about a week and a half after that event because lay people perhaps thought I was hallucinating this event at the hotel room or something like that, and perhaps talking about being poisoned didn't sit well with people either. It's just an occurrence that no one knows how to deal with or no one really has heard of, you know. So anyway, that was my experience for that day. And with the organized stalking and their tactics, that is a lot of what we deal with as targeted individuals, is fighting against the tide, as not being automatically perceived as having a mental illness or a mental event, such as hallucinating something, being paranoid or something like that. That's the tragedy of it.
I understand you only need 2 people to say that you need to be hospitalized in Arizona. Is that true?
That is true. 2 lay people. You know, people with no medical degree, medical background, medical knowledge. And it can be, you know, 2 family members, 2 friends. It can be 2 strangers who have never met. They just have to submit statements to the court saying, well, this person maybe said this, or this person was acting this way, we're worried or concerned. And that's all it takes is two people submitting statements like that to the court. The court issues some kind of order to the police, wherever you live. They automatically, they pick you up. They take you to a holding facility, and you're held there for maybe 24 hours before then you're sent to a hospital involuntarily, yes, to lay people.
Well, this is before you moved to Virginia, but you went back to your apartment, and the neighbors that were causing problems for you were evicted, or they stopped paying rent. But that's another sign of some shenanigans going on with potential involvement with the organized stalking program.
Yes, I had gone back to pick up a couple of furniture pieces, and the apartment manager had told me the neighbors, they were directly across from me, were evicted. They had stopped paying rent right after I had moved from that place. And they were evicted. And I don't know what happened to them, but I didn't find that coincidental at all, to be honest with you. As a matter of fact, one night that I had to call, or I called 911 while living there, just as the police were coming up, these neighbors, these people, this was about 3 a.m. in the morning, these couple, they were running out their door with backpacks on at 3 in the morning. And I remember, you know, opening the door as the police, just as these people are coming out of their apartment with backpacks on, saying, can you talk to them? Can you detain them? These events have been going on specific to them, and they would not do that. And I had called the police because I had seen my deadbolt, you know, turning, and I knew someone was coming in. At that point, I called 911 and shut myself in my room. But, yeah, when the police arrived, my neighbors were running out their door, but nothing happened over that, unfortunately.
Right. That's some shady activity, especially in the context of what you've been going through. In your current location, you had an Apache helicopter, I believe, come very low over your property. That's another common occurrence for some of the organized stalking. And you live in a very small town in Virginia. Tell listeners about this, please.
Yes. Gosh, this was probably within a month, month and a half after I had relocated here as well. And it was probably later afternoon, there was an Apache helicopter that hovered over this particular house for, gosh, 5-6 seconds at least. It was directly over the rooftop. The whole house was shaking, as if, you know, an earthquake or something like that, just shaking and rattling. And that struck me as incredibly odd because there's no military base around here, nor did this Apache helicopter hover over any other house in this very, very residential area. And like you said, yes, very small town. You know, there were a couple witnesses seeing this, you know, the Apache, obviously complete with guns on either side. That was, yes, very disconcerting.
This is the second interview that we're doing with you, and I noticed that the organized stalking had started when Katie, a past guest, who was experiencing horrendous voice-to-skull attacks, but when she began dating people she met online, that's when a lot of the attacks occurred. She can pinpoint it to when it started. You met your ex-fiancé online, and you can trace the organized stalking back to him, and you spoke with a mutual friend of your ex-fiancé, and could you tell listeners what she said?
Yes, and I had actually decided to get in touch with her. I hadn't, you know, been in touch for a couple of years. And I decided to get in touch with her because I had remembered something he said to me several years back, which was, she's dead to me. And he said that was because they had some kind of falling out, some kind of fight when he had been visiting the area at that time. And that always struck me as odd. I had never asked her about it, but, you know, in light of everything that had been happening to me here, I thought, gosh, you know, that may be some kind of connection, a useful information that I might be able to obtain or to help my case, so to speak. So I reached out to her and, you know, we were just catching up and I was, you know, telling her about my, you know, situation, just being very afraid and not understanding what was going on. And she just happened to mention this falling out. And I had actually asked her about it too, but, you know, pressed her for more detail later on. And she couldn't even remember, she said, what they had argued about or had this horrible falling out about, but because it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. But she said the day after he left, her phone started blowing up, in a manner of speaking, basically with, you know, odd text messages, a lot of wrong messages, sex type, you know, very lewd text messages received, hundreds of prank emails or, you know, advertisements, things like that, just hundreds of obviously messages not meant for her, text, email, even phone calls, lots of wrong number calls daily. And she said it was so bad she thought about changing her number. But what she also said to me that just really struck me was, I think he must be part of some type of organized stalking group. And I remember feeling so shocked over that because I hadn't mentioned organized stalking to her or anything like that yet. I just kind of wanted to see her input and find out what had transpired between them. So to me, when she said that, that was just another, not even clue, but just, you know, fact that my ex-fiance is behind all of my organized stalking.
Definite cautionary tale here about meeting people online.
Yes, absolutely.
Susan, before we say goodbye, would you please describe a little bit more of the symptoms of the microwave attacks you're experiencing? Because you have a range of health issues, including effects to your nervous system. Share with listeners, please, some of these health repercussions.
Oh, yes. Thanks for asking. I am either very, very cold, and that sounds kind of mundane to say, but I mean just shivering to death almost, just trembling, almost like I've been electrified in a way, like my whole nervous system is in shock. I'm just trembling to death, or I'm also, on the flip side, just burning up. I feel like I've been burned from the inside out, and that's, it's hard to explain, but those are the best terms I can use. I will wake up with just tremendous headaches. Just, it feels like my head's going to explode. Extreme ear pressure and pain. Tinnitus, the ringing sounds. Sometimes it's high-pitched screeching almost, or just low hums. I mean, my hair, like a horrible array of just ear, you know, I don't know, ear noises, and that's from, you know, the microwave effect. It's hard for me to walk some days, maintain my balance. Sometimes I sway from side to side. It's hard for me to think. I have a lot of cognitive issues, you know, short-term memory loss, lack of focus, hard to concentrate, things like that, a lot of joint pain, muscle pain, and things like that. It's just a whole array of systemic symptoms, and it just gets worse and worse.
If listeners are wondering why we're talking about this topic in multiple interviews, it's because I perceive this as an epidemic in our society right now, not only in the United States, but Canada and parts of Europe. People are suffering quietly. By doing these interviews, sometimes people will identify with this, a listener will identify with it and reach out and connect into with the guest. And there are organizations such as PACS International, P-A-C-T-S International. And there are other organizations. Our guest, Susan Conley, can point you toward. Susan, could you please give your email out to listeners if they want to reach out to you?
Sure. It's Feline Girl. That's F-E-L-I-N-E-G-I-R-L-L-L @gmail.com.
Susan, once again, I want to thank you for being a guest on In Other News and sharing these horrendous experiences, but important to document nonetheless. Thank you for being on In Other News.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.